Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. And today, it's a kind of rare occurrence. I don't do very many first novels on the show. And a book came my way called The Book of X by Sarah Rose Etter. It's her first novel. It comes from a press called $2 Radio. I became exposed to $2 Radio because they had published a book by Rudy Wurlitzer. Rudy had not published a novel in years and years, and it was his choice. He could have published anywhere. People were waiting for his new book, and he published with $2 Radio. So I started reading books as they came out from $2 Radio, and this book, The Book of X by Sarah Rose Etter, is one of the most recent ones. Now, first of all, who are you?
I'm a girl who grew up in Pottstown, Pennsylvania, next to some power plants. And my whole life, I was a big reader. You know, my dad was always reading me the New York Times while I was in my diaper. So words have always been, you know, really important to me. And I was voraciously making books, even really young. My dad has these copies of, you know, stapled together notepads that I had made to write books out of crayon. So you could say I started pretty young.
This is the first book coming after a chapbook called The Tongue Party. And The Book of X is around six times as long as that chapbook. And where did it come from?
Well, Tongue Party was my thesis in graduate school, and, you know, it was accepted by Deb Olin Unferth to win the Cake Train Press Award. And so it was much smaller. I edited it down. My thesis was actually much longer, but when I knew it was getting published, I got really crazy about editing, so I edited it down pretty heavily. The Book of X was actually much longer, and I edited that down very heavily as well. So it's actually only about, I think, 45,000 words, but with the formatting and how it's laid out, it's kind of a series of visions and facts, so it gets a little bit of length there.
Now, it is done in brief sections, and that's not unusual for postmodern novels. Donald Barthelme, about whom Sarah Rose Etter and I have just been speaking, he's one of our favorite writers.
Yes. Agreed, agreed.
And he wrote in small sections as well. And what is the benefit of small sections is you can get things right in small sections that you can't get right in longer ones. Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about X.
I really just started writing this book to tell the story of a female body that was different and other. And I had been looking at a lot of art. Louise Bourgeois, I'm a big fan of her work. And she has quite a few sculptures of these twisted up women who are very knotted. And I really do believe that first line came from her subconsciously because I had been very obsessed with her work.
Tell everyone the first line.
Oh, I was born a knot like my mother and her mother before her. And that line kind of got stuck in my head for quite a few months before I actually started to write the book. And then I just had to give myself permission to follow her life and let it unfold. And the reason I love Donald Barthelme so much, he talks a lot about not knowing when you begin to write. And I really felt that with this book, that I let it take me into a world and kind of reveal itself to me.
Yes, he wrote an essay called On Not Knowing, and then he put together a book of his essays, I think, that was also involved with not knowing, and he thought that knowing too much would be destructive for a writer. I assume this is your first book after graduate school, yes?
Yes. Once I graduated and after Tongue Party came out, I had written another collection, and then I had spine surgery. And after the spinal surgery, I looked at the collection I had written, and I thought that whole collection was garbage. So I pulled it, and then I really started to work on this book. And, you know, I think I made a structure. I knew that I needed to have some kind of a semblance. So I had an outline that there would be three parts, and I knew that. And I sketched out each part a little bit, and then I gave myself the freedom to let the scenes come and the visuals come, because I think with surrealism, you really want to give yourself space to play.
It's in three parts. The woman, Cassie, begins at home in a sort of urban setting. She moves to the city where she gets a job at an office, and then she moves again. The book is following her into the places that she doesn't know how to go. It's a surrealist feminist novel. And the reason I know that is because you've given a lecture on surrealist feminism. But tell us what that is.
Well, if you think about surrealism in the beginning, it was a male movement, right? All the women that were involved in that movement were inspiration or muses or wives, and they were really there to support the men around them. So when I say surrealism, it is a little bit of a reclaiming of that term, because there are many women who were working in the surrealist vein who wouldn't use that word for what they do. That's largely because it was so male dominated.
Well, it's terrible, because I read a book of, I think, letters by Dorothea Tanning, and she had been Max Ernst's wife. And she was better known as Max Ernst's wife than as a surrealist.
Yeah.
But she was brilliant.
Yeah.
And she was an artist. And she was a writer. $2 Radio itself started to publish books by women with greater regularity. Everyone is starting to learn not only how to look, but they have to look. Mm-hmm. What have you been finding?
I've been finding that I'm very excited to see a reexamination of the bodies of work of women. And that's, you know, Dorothy Tanning is one of them. Leonora Carrington is another one. Dorothy Press has been putting out really great work. That's one of the best, the collected stories of Leonora Carrington. That makes me very excited. I find those stories quite strange and glowing, and they're just very, like, special morsels.
What is her name again? Leonora Carrington.
Yeah.
Let's tell everyone, because she's so good.
Yeah, she's wonderful.
She's wonderful. And, you know, a long time ago, all of these works were in print. Mm-hmm. Then they went out of print. And one by one, they're coming back. They're being rediscovered. I'm forgetting as we sit here, but that's another sign, too, the name of the Brazilian writer.
Clarice Lispector.
Clarice Lispector.
Yep.
Also astounding. Yep. And brilliant. Now Clarice Lispector is starting to be well known, but still The Apples in the Dark has not been republished.
Well, bring it back. It's time.
Yes. Well, it's time. You see, that's the whole thing. It's time to rediscover literature. Because, you see, transgendered people have always had literature. Women have always had literature. Men, I remember, men used to make such fun of Doris Lessing.
Oh.
And when I finally read The Golden Notebook, I said to Doris, who I was doing an event with, I said, all of these male critics have been dismissing you in the most outlandish and inappropriate ways. And she said, I know, you have no idea what that felt like to write what I knew was very likely my very best book, and to have these people telling me that not only was I not a writer, but that more likely than not, I was crazy. I'm talking to Sarah Rose Etter about her first novel, The Book of X. It's published by $2 radio. So a young woman named
Cassie,
who is Cassandra, who is, I assume, a prophetess, who was the name of the woman in your first chapbook. So this X is a knot into which the girl, the woman, we weren't allowed to say girl. You said girl before. Do people say girl now?
I think I called her girl because I know her from her youth too. You know, womanhood, right? Me and Cassie go back a long way.
Okay. This woman, she's born as her mother was and her grandmother, Eleanor, with her esophagus tied in a knot. Mm-hmm. And this knot hangs out over the table.
Mm-hmm.
It's shocking because her mother's breasts sag over that knot.
Mm-hmm. But hers do not.
Hers
her
do
youth.
Not.
Yes.
Because?
She's young.
And her breasts are?
Small.
Exactly. Yeah. And the way in which this book is proceeding is by asking, how do we take this woman about whom everything can be taken to be wrong and give her a full-blooded life? Well, first you take her away from home. Why? 'Cause at home
she has some support and she has her father. And she has this, you know, meat quarry that she loves so much that her family works from. I think the reason she needed to go to this city was in order to kind of juxtapose the surrealism of her youth with the realities of capitalism. I think her story is very much the story of being raised in a sort of rural area and then moving to an urban area.
Her family lives at a place called the Acres. And the Acres have a quarry. It's not your regular stone quarry or rock quarry. It's a meat quarry. And they harvest meat there. She yanks at this meat that grows on cliff-like walls with fat growing amidst the red meat. Mm-hmm. Eventually, she gets sick of meat, yes, and she moves to the city, and she's going to encounter all these other women, just as at school they've made terrible bullying fun of her knot.
Mm-hmm. And in the city, she sort of disappears almost. That, you know, I think that was what was necessary. She goes from being this central figure in high school where everyone's mocking her and they're watching her all the time. And in the city, she almost disappears. You know, small comments are made about her body, but she gets even less attention somehow.
But what she is someone who doesn't know how to be Cassie. She doesn't know. She may have a mother and a grandmother who were born with a knot, but the doctors don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors don't know how to remove it or untie it or change it in any way. One day she goes into the doctor to discover that she needs a series of 27 shots just to loosen the knot. And as he injects her, the doctor says what I think is the strangest single sentence in the book. What does the doctor say?
Here comes the sugar water.
Sugar water, sugar water, sugar water.
Yeah.
With each injection.
Yeah.
Why?
You know, that actually is one part of the book that's true. When I had a spinal surgery, I was really desperate for help, and I had gone to probably 38 doctors, and no one knew what was wrong with me. And I found this man who said that he could make the pain go away, And he gave me, I think, 27 injections, and he called it the sugar water. And it wound up in the book because it felt like so surreal and so strange to be in pain and have someone offering sugar water to you.
Now, what is her relation to men? First man she's serious about is someone she meets in high school. The first woman who doesn't make fun of her, Sophia,
becomes her friend for life, even if it's tenuous. And
she looks at the knot and she says, "That's disgusting." And yet she says, "You know, pull your blouse down." But then they find a way to remain friends. Same thing with the first man. He demands to see the knot, says, "That's disgusting," and falls in love with her anyway. So this is a novel that's hugely constructed out of ambivalence.
Yeah, and I think it's also a reflection of their age groups. You know, you've got young kids who don't know what to do with strangeness or weirdness. And as she gets older, that changes a little. But I think for the kids in high school, they don't know anything other than disgust for how she looks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Sarah Rose Etter about her first novel, The Book of X. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Sarah Rose Etter about her new book, The Book of X, A Surreal Landscape of One Woman's Haunted Life. It's published by $2 Radio. Now, how long would you say it took you to arrive at the voice in this book? And how many times did you write it in order to arrive at the voice?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I think we have this idea that the sentences just arrive, and really they're labored over for so long. So I came up with the idea probably 5 years ago for the book. And then I wrote the bulk of it in Iceland on a residency for 30 days. I lived in a cabin by myself in rural Iceland. So every morning I just woke up and wrote, and the sun was only going down for maybe 5 hours a day. So it felt felt like I was there for many, many years. So I wrote about 70,000 words in those 30 days, and it was pretty manic and insane. And then I came home and started editing, and I was reading a lot of poetry and a lot of Brian Evanson and Anne Carson and these writers who are so concerned with the line. And as soon as I knew that $2 Radio was going to publish it, I went into what could be described as kind of a mania for a few months, where I just was editing like crazy. I mean, I still have stacks. I probably edited, I don't know, 8 or 9 times in 4 months. Just because I wanted to get the lines right, and I knew that if I wanted to write a weird book, the sentences would need to be so beautiful. Otherwise, I was going to lose the reader. Revision was a huge part of it. It took a very long time to get it right. It's in a lineage that is so different from, you know, what would be mass fiction. And it's part of literature that I think is in conversation with the grotesque and with the surreal.
It really is a novel about someone to whom life doesn't come easily. Now, I don't know about you, but I know my life didn't come easily, and I suspect yours didn't either.
Yes, I've been thinking about this a lot. There's some research around, you know, the books that were coming out in the 80s in mass market, you know, fiction. How they were very kind of heroic, right? There's this hero's journey and everything gets better for the main character. And with this book, I did want to reflect the fact that life gets better and then it gets worse and then it gets better again, right? It really is a string of tragedies and beauties over and over and over again. So I'm glad you took that from the text, because I think it's really important that we, you know, I think when I look at Ocean Vuong's book, On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous, and a couple of the other novels that are coming out this year, I think we're starting to see a move toward a novel that isn't in search of resolve. It's not in search of redemption or everything getting better. It is, life is loose ends, and, you know, it doesn't always become something tied up with a pretty bow.
Now, when I was in college, Donald Barthelme, John Barth, William Gass, John Hawkes were all writing and publishing novels. None of these writers that I'm naming had been to a writing program. The writers that you're naming, Ocean, you've been to writing programs. How important do you think that is?
You know, I think my experience, I come to it a little differently. I went to a small college because I was working full-time and they had a degree at night. And so I finished my MFA in the evenings and I wrote on nights and weekends. I was also a real outlier in that program. There were a lot of people writing traditional fiction, historical romance novels, and I would show up with these insane stories like Koala Tide. You know, they've read that and the whole workshop was just looking at me like, what is wrong with you?
Koala Tide is the first of the short stories in the chapbook Tongue Party, which preceded the Book of Acts. Yeah. Yes, I can imagine, and yet, once upon a time, as I say, the teachers who were teaching fiction at the State University of New York at Buffalo, where I was an undergraduate, were first John Barth and then Donald Barthelme, and this was what they were looking for. Romantic historical fiction would not have been, it would not have been being written right at a university writing program.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny. I had one professor who was reading my work and he started to slip me Donald Barthelme stories. And it was him and actually early Ben Marcus, The Age of Wire and String.
Wonderful book.
Wonderful. And I started to read this work and understand that it was okay to write something that might be strange and have the shape of a sculpture.
Now, talk to me a little bit about Louise Bourgeois.
Yeah, she was one of my favorite artists. I just love the fact that she moves between mediums. You know, she's painting, she's sketching. She was also, if you watch any documentaries, she was, you know, had a temper. She was a little crazy, and I really like that about her. But her work, I mean, you know, if you look at her cells, she did a series of 100 giant wire cell sculptures that are massive and complicated, and there are bits of mirror and glass and teeth. And, you know, they're beautiful, but they're complicated and they're almost tumor-like. And I really do take a lot of inspiration from visual art, which is why I think Donald Barthelme, you know, was so important to me as a writer, and Ben Marcus as well. They were both making sculptural work. They were writing things that came off the page, truly.
Well, as you and my listeners may know, Donald Barthelme began as a curator at an art museum, and he didn't like anything that came naturalistically. He was a reader of great and profound perception. If John Barth was the teacher who taught people about structure, Donald was the teacher who taught people about words and sentences. That was what Donald did. He wrote sentences. I loved him. What he used to do, if he found a dead word in a sentence, he would ask the class to vote on a better word.
Wow.
And he'd stand up at the blackboard and write down the suggestions and then count the votes for each word and put the one that got the most votes in. The idea was you never put in a word that people were expecting. Using the expected word was almost like a sin. We used to call it experimental writing. What do you call it?
I mean, I tend to go to surrealism, but I know that, you know, it is still experimental. I think here I really wanted to create a book that was commercially paced but still surreal as sort of a way to Trojan horse the weirdness, right? Because if the pace picks you up, you might be more likely to go along for the ride. But yes, surrealism or experimental, that would work.
Well, I would say that what I'm seeing bit by bit is a new generation of experimental writing is trying to get itself born. It's trying to somehow still come out of writing programs that might be teaching very conventional backgrounds to writing, beginning, middle, and end, that kind of thing. But something seems to be happening, maybe because our lives are becoming so strange, maybe because, as in this book, our sexualities are becoming so strange. I mean, the heroine of this book, well, it takes a very long time for her to feel safe in the presence of love. Mm. Love is the ultimate unsafety.
It's true.
In this book, from parents, from family, from lovers, from friends. Love is the place the book is trying to get to. And does it get there?
A little bit. She gets a brief glimpse and a brief reprieve. But, you know, I do think this book is dealing also a lot with trauma and what it does to the brain and how do we live in the world when we don't know what love is and we don't have a model for it. And I love what you're saying about this new era of experimental writing, because that makes me excited to write. You know, that's, I feel there are so many novels. And everyone knows the formula for a perfect novel. That exists. And many people could write it because there's a math to it almost, right? It's taught right now. What I was interested in is how do you undo that and also create a story that's still compelling? How do you make something new?
I've been talking with Sarah Rose Etter. Her book, it's her first novel, is The Book of X. It's published by $2 Radio. A very interesting press. Thank you, Sarah Rose Etter, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, just about all the podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Katja Apakina is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.